Good morning, this is Hugh LaFollick, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'll be talking with Eugene Skolnikov, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at MIT, and also formerly in the White House Science Office for Presidents Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Carter, and we're going to be discussing international scientific cooperation. Eugene, glad to have you on the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I think it'd be helpful to place this discussion in a bit of historical context. So I wonder if you could say a little bit about what role scientists have played in shaping national policies and enhancing, or at least enhancing, the possibility of international cooperation.
Well, many of the scientists that have been involved in national policymaking got their training experience, getting wet behind the ears during World War II, and they learned very vividly how to play a role in national policymaking and were a major factor in the outcome of World War II. Though most of them expected to return to the laboratories after the war, when the Cold War broke out, they found themselves back working in government and with a lot of experience and knowledge about the system. And with a considerable, I think, two things. One, a certain disdain for the role, particularly the military, and the ability to use science and technology. And secondly, I think in terms of cooperation, even more important, a strong view that science could be a bridge, could be a way of ameliorating and overcoming the political divisions, particularly between the United States and the Soviet Union, and were avidly pushing over time the idea of trying to use science as a scientific cooperation as a way of reaching the Soviet Union, the influential members of the Soviet Union. The scientists in the Soviet Union tended to be very close to the leadership and very influential in policy there.
Okay, and one thing you mentioned in your book that I thought was of some interest, and it might be one of the earlier examples of at least attempts at cooperation, was that Kennedy made gestures toward the Soviets to try to work toward a joint project in space exploration. I wonder if you could tell a bit about what happened there and maybe if there are some ways in which the problems which arose there are indicative of problems we're facing now.
Yeah, that was obviously an interesting period. You may remember the Russian Sputnik went up in 1957, the first satellite. That was part of the International Geophysical Year. That is, it was a big multinational, a program run by the scientists, supported by governments, but run by the scientific community, to study the Earth and the Earth's surroundings. And it was a coordinated scientific effort. It was a major program of scientific cooperation. As part of it, both the United States and the Soviet Union agreed to launch satellites. We never took it quite seriously that they would. But they were the first in 1957, and that led to a huge reaction in the United States. Led to the creation of the Space Agency in 1958. But the world believed that the Soviet Union was ahead of the United States, and partly because they were first in space, but more generally because their propaganda was very effective. It was clear they weren't, but there was no real way of demonstrating that. When Kennedy came into office, he first thought that maybe could use the space program as a way both for creating some better political relationships, a form of détente, a word that we didn't use then but did later under Nixon, with the Soviet Union, and also to demonstrate in that process that the United States was, in fact, at least the equal and probably better than the Soviet Union. That didn't get very far, though Kennedy did talk about it early on, but then the Soviet Union launched Gagarin, put into orbit the first man in space, and that created a great reaction again around the world about one more demonstration of Soviet Union's leadership. At that point, that's when Kennedy decided to launch Project Apollo to get to the moon in the decade of the 1960s, which was even further given impetus by the very difficult and the meeting between Kennedy and Khrushchev in Vienna in 1961, which was really a debacle from the point of view of President Kennedy. Khrushchev treated him as a sort of a second-rate leader. And that only emboldened the president even further. So that any ideas, immediate ideas for space cooperation for political purposes weren't pushed very hard, though even then, very quickly, the administration began to talk about the possibility of a joint link-up of American and Soviet satellites in space, man-carrying satellites. That didn't have come to pass until the mid-1970s, but it was a serious discussion that was held even in the early 1960s. At the same time, the administration, Kennedy, strongly pushed use of space capabilities for international political purposes in a speech that Kennedy made at the UN in 1961, for example, that led to the creation of Intelsat, the first communication satellite program, which was the United States took the lead to create an international program, not just a national program. That kind of positive and forthcoming attitude towards international cooperation in space activities really didn't survive very long in that strong impetus that Kennedy had given to it.
Okay, I want to go back to something you said earlier. You said that scientists, or that science was, I'm not quite sure which, science was, or at least scientists saw themselves as being potentially a bridge between countries. What is it about science that made scientists think that it was potentially this kind of bridge?
Well, they feel very, very strongly. I'm going to say they, though I think it's these are views commonly held by the scientific community. There are some that don't agree, but I think by and large, the scientists felt that that the very nature of science, both the fact that facts are facts across borders, that they do not change in the Soviet Union and the United States, and scientists to progress scientifically have to deal with facts and the same facts. And secondly, that science itself is the value system that is sort of essential to progress, that is to conduct experiments legitimately, to not change results, not cook the results, to publish, to build on each other's work, made it, in a sense, a community that was quite independent of national borders. And over centuries, this has been recognized. Back in the 17th, 18th centuries, there were comments from leaders about separating science and scientists from the normal political rivalries between countries. And so scientists felt that they had a special channel of communication that was somehow separate from the values, the political value systems of the countries. They thought this could be used to somehow ameliorate or lessen the political controversies. And in the most notable step in this direction in the early post-war years was the Pugwash movement. Pugwash being a town in Nova Scotia, which happened to be the summer home of Cyrus Eaton, who was a steel financier from Cleveland, and who financed the early Pugwash meetings. And that was Pugwash was started by Bertrand Russell, a philosopher, with support by Einstein and with other scientists to try to see if you couldn't use science to bridge these political gaps between the East and West. And it still exists. It is an organization that involved many of the leading scientists over time. It has played, I think, an important political role at various times, this kind of willingness to meet and discuss openly issues. For example, the Pugwash context, the early debates about missile defense, this is going back to the 1960s, the Soviets had always had a view that defense was always good. There could be nothing wrong with defense. And in the West, the United States particularly was already realized that sometimes if you have a strong defense, you actually may make the situation, a political situation, military situation, more volatile. And it took time, but eventually the Soviet scientists came to understand the argument, and that led and greatly eased the ability to develop an ABM treaty, anti-ballistic missile treaty, in the early 1970s. So these relationships and the building on the contacts and concepts and ideas and values of the scientific community were felt to be a potentially very useful way to try to find ways of getting around the political barriers and common and conflicts.
Okay, so there was a desire to have some kind of means of opening lines of communication between countries that appeared to be competing, and scientists saw science as having a unique ability to do that because it was thought that the correct conduct of science was borderless.
That's right.
It just didn't follow political boundaries. At the same time, though, there are things you said which indicated that that science was often a source of enormous competition. It was competition in a variety of ways. One, it was simply seen as a matter of prestige. They were the first people to put someone in space. We were the first person to put someone on the moon. There was that kind of competition. And clearly, you also alluded to this earlier, there's a competition because scientific advancements are often seen as being incredibly important for the military. So I take it there's this other side which makes cooperation between scientists fairly difficult.
You're quite right. There is this constant tension between cooperation and competition. And I think the scientists, as a generalization, as a group, think that cooperation is much more important than any potential loss of leadership or of information. And non-scientists, particularly in the government, tend to be more concerned about the question of leadership and the question of loss of information. This has played out, but let me just a couple of examples from the past and the present. One, very early on, when both countries were pushing for atomic weapons and then hydrogen weapons as soon as they could, and in a clear competition with high secrecy about those issues, the American scientists pushed hard for opening up some of the technical information about atomic energy. Not the military, of course, but still there's a close relationship. And they pushed hard for what we call the Atoms for Peace conferences that were held starting in the Eisenhower years and later, which, in a sense, forced the Soviet Union to give much more information about what they were doing and where it stood, and again created a certain kind of bridge among these scientists to exchange information. In the process, it, of course, it had some non-scientific goals. It also showed how strong the United States science was. And it also served to one of the goals of cooperation was to demonstrate to a closed society what the great benefits and values are of an open society. The scientists thought that was a very important part of payoff or value of cooperation. And so there's been this constant tension. Today we have a conflict brewing, a problem brewing, an issue brewing, where the federal government is sufficiently concerned about loss of or leakage of scientific information that might be used for space missiles and space capabilities of potentially hostile nations, that there is a growing barrier being put in the place for space cooperation among scientists, space science cooperation, on the grounds that in the process it may be helping other countries to develop their military satellite systems. And this is becoming a much more serious issue, and one that doesn't have a lot of public attention yet, but I think it's going to create real problems in the coming years. So this tension exists, and it's not always obvious how to navigate best through the maze. And given the events of September 11th, it makes it even harder, obviously, and greater concern about information reaching hands that you'd rather not have that information in.
I'd like to maybe go both directions here. The one example that seems to be one, to the outsider at least, of genuine cooperation is the International Space Station, though I take it that you have at least some questions or misgivings about the way that is proceeding. So I wonder if you could describe for the listener a little bit about what the plan or program is for the International Space Station, and then articulate some of your questions or misgivings.
Well, the International Space Station is a fascinating technological endeavor. It is undoubtedly the largest cooperative technological program that's ever been attempted. The total cost is a little hard to calculate, but the expected cost to the United States alone is close to $40 billion. It started out in the early 1980s as a program estimated about $8 billion and was approved finally by the Reagan administration. And it is so costly and involved so much in terms of technological construction and ideas and concepts that it really couldn't be carried out effectively by one country, at least not at the scale that they were talking about it. We had an earlier space station called Space Lab, which we did do, the United States did do alone, and that was much smaller, but also very effective, in fact. But in any case, this concept, which was very controversial at the time, and I should identify the fact that I was one of those that strongly opposed it, not the idea of a space station, but the idea of this station. We didn't need it, and it wasn't at the time. But in any case, it went ahead, and it is now in place. That is, the station isn't yet finished, but it's up there. But in the process, the costs have enormously escalated, and escalated to the point at which the intention to have 7 crew members, American astronauts, that is, astronauts put up by the United States, it might include some foreigners as well, 7 in residence on the station at all times, both to maintain it and to conduct scientific research, has now become financially impossible. So that there's something like a $4 billion overrun, and the result of one consequence of that is that the crew size is going to be cut from 7 to 3. That basically means that no scientific research can effectively be done on the station, at least not by Americans. It's possible that in the Russian module that they may be able to do some scientific research, which would be rather odd in the sense that our astronauts would be providing the servicing, the homekeeping for research done by others. The original goal of the station was supposedly to be to do scientific research. In fact, it was, remember, created and thought of in the context of the Cold War, was to demonstrate, once again, the prestige and prowess of our capabilities in space. By now, but its first ostensible goal was science, and by now, very little science is going to get done on it, and there was an argument even at the beginning that there wasn't much science that would be done on it, other than learning more about the experience of astronauts in space, which is clearly we will learn how people actually fare in substantial periods of time. But some of the other potential goals, microgravity research and other life science research, no one is really thinks is very serious or couldn't be done other ways, much less expensively. So there's a real problem. It is a major cooperative effort, but the United States is now going to be pulling back, and the effect on our collaborators in space, the space station, are not at all clear. I should, one other thing let me say about this, and it sounds being critical, that this is an example of something else, and I'm afraid has bedeviled our space program right from the beginning with regard to international cooperation, at least until recently. And that is what I would call a sort of a warped view or distorted view of what cooperation means. Typically, we have decided what we want to do in a particular project and from NASA, and then asked others to participate in that project. It's only been fairly recently, on the major technological projects at least, that there has been a realization that cooperation means you start from the beginning to cooperate and plan jointly. You don't decide what you want to do and ask some to join you. Kind of an arrogance that we have been accused of often, and I'm afraid this was another example. And the space station is an example of that, because as the costs ballooned, In the 1990s, in the Clinton administration, Vice President Gort was given responsibility to figure out what to do about these ballooning costs. And the United States unilaterally redesigned the station, cutting it back without prior consultation with the countries that are already signed on, and just assumed that the others would follow suit. And now, in a sense, we're doing it again, but now we don't have much choice in the matter. But I think we've learned, and NASA is much better now, particularly in space science, of seeing the need for consultation with others at the beginning, not halfway through the process.
Now, that debate sort of between a unilateral and multilateral science, or at least unilateral and multilateral technology, does lead us back to the question which you raised earlier, this looming battle between the desire of science to share information across boundaries and the increasing fact that we're afraid to share knowledge across boundaries because we're afraid that others will use that knowledge against us, not just to whip us in the economic market, but perhaps to annihilate us. And as you alluded earlier, clearly events of September the 11th and the subsequent anthrax attacks make that perhaps even more apparent. But I wonder if you discuss this problem and if you see any way out.
Well, this is one of these problems for which there is no, quote, solution. That is, there are not just powerful arguments on both sides, but there are legitimate arguments on both sides. That is, the concern about the proliferation of knowledge that can be used for military purposes is a genuine concern. I would point out in that connection, by the way, that all technologies are dual use, meaning all technologies can be used either for good or for good or ill purposes. So that you run into a problem right away about what technology, how to think about technology that's might be used either way, and how do you measure the risks that are involved that it would be used for hostile purposes. In any case, what we have now and we see in the space area, the specifics are, without getting into great detail, there's something called ITAR, International Traffic in Arms Regulations, that are administered by the State Department. And they, if you want to give any information to a foreigner about any item that's on that munitions list, so-called, and space satellites are on the munitions list, you have to get a prior license. The prior license takes, if you get it at all, takes maybe 9 months. The State Department is completely overwhelmed by the request for licenses. Fundamental research is excluded from this requirement. However, you don't do space research without involving space technology, so that doesn't solve the problem. And if carried out to its letter of the law, a scientist in an American university that wants to do some some research on a satellite, cannot talk to his foreign-born graduate student about the technology involved without getting a prior license. Or he cannot talk to scientists in Europe about the technology involved without getting a prior license. Now, that might not sound so onerous, but in fact, in practice, you can't make that neat separation between the research and the technology. They're intimately tied up. And so there is an increasing concern on the part of the university community about the research universities doing this as to how to either get around these rules, change them, comply with them, recognizing that there is a genuine concern. Now, some of the concern is not so genuine. That is, in the sense that I think a lot of people in the government, what they're concerned about is that China is going to be our future major competitor in strategic policy, and they want to stop the Chinese from getting any information. I think a much greater genuine concern is this question of non-state actors, terrorist groups. How do you keep them from getting information that could be useful in biological warfare or even in missiles and so on? And that there's no, as I say, there's no, quote, solution to that. I think the universities are going to be dragged into being more concerned about b- what foreign students they accept, perhaps more concerned than they are at the moment to monitoring where they are and whether they stick to the same fields they were admitted for and so on. This is anathema to many universities, so I don't know how that's going to be played out. And at the moment, there are no real studies of this or there's no attempt really to come together, I don't think, on the issue. I think many in the government don't really understand what drives the universities, what values are important to them. At the same time, I think the universities tend to just object to the rules when, in fact, there's some genuine issues involved.
All right, let me just say two things. We only have about 2.5 minutes left here, but one is, I mean, it is interesting about this concern about sharing what might be called exotic knowledge that we think only we have. I mean, what happened on September the 11th was brought about not by anything terribly exotic,
exactly. But
by something that we share across borders all the time, namely how to build an airplane or how to fly an airplane. And in fact, it seems to me that there's going to be an interesting tension between the push on the part of the United States toward a global economic market is going to seem to likewise lead to a push to sharing of knowledge across borders, that if we're wanting to have this kind of global economic exchange, which we now think is so valuable, by its very nature, that's going to have to lead to some kind of sharing of information across borders. So do you have any suggestions as someone who's worked in three different White Houses about at least how we might try to approach this problem in the last minute and a half here?
The short answer is no. I mean, we already have that situation you described. Since so much of the economy has, to use a term that has become a pejorative term, globalization, so much of the world's economy now is involved, the large companies that are multinational in nature, information is, in fact, shared. I think there's no simple answer to how to control the information. There's some very esoteric information that can be controlled for a period of time, but it can't be controlled forever. I think much more to the point is that the way to deal, the only way that's over time successfully is a political one to deal with these issues. For example, we were always concerned how many nations were capable of building atomic weapons. Many more nations are capable of it than have done it. More, India and Pakistan have done it recently. However, the pace of that kind of proliferation has slowed as much less than was anticipated. And that's largely through political action, through incentives to making it clear that it's not something that helps those countries, that there are penalties attached, and so forth. And I think that all of this that we're talking about is really going to get subsumed under a larger political, geopolitical relationships among countries rather than be dealt with on these issues directly. It's how the overall relationships are worked out and then it's going to determine whether these are serious issues or not.
Okay, I hate to say it, we're out of time. I've been speaking today with Eugene Skolnikoff, Professor Emeritus in Political Science at MIT and member of three different White Houses in the Science Office. We've been talking about international science cooperation. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.